24, sunny tomorrow, still dry but cooler, tomorrow's high 58. Expanded forecast, rain and snow on Wednesday, a high of just 38. For Thursday, a chance of rain and thunderstorms, windy. Thursday's high 49. For Friday, we'll start to dry out, just a slight chance of rain. Friday's high around 45. Sun will set this evening at 7:26. Right now we have sunshine and 51 degrees, humidity 92%. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show will be spent exploring a very troubling human phenomenon, which is not really new, but we are thinking about it perhaps in some new ways right now. We're going to be talking about narcissism and the various sort of flavors or degrees of narcissism and the way in which narcissism is playing out right now in American society in some very, very dramatic ways. The book at hand is called Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. And the book is by Dr. Lori Helgo, who is a clinical psychologist, educator, and author. And she has written a great deal on the relationship between personality and individual psychological issues and overall culture. She is associate professor of behavioral science at the Ross University School of Medicine. And she has written a number of books already, and this is her most recent. It is published by Diversion, again titled Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. And Dr. Lori Helgo, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
I think it's really important right off the bat that we talk just for a moment about the name that is in the title of your book, because I think people may possibly misunderstand the primary thrust of your book, the primary intent of your book. This book is not about President Donald Trump, nor is this a book that spells out some sort of diagnosis of President Trump being a narcissist or a certain kind of narcissist, although you maybe touch on some of those provocative or troubling possibilities. But that's not so much what this book is about. You explain why the last name of the president is in the subtitle of the book, and in a sense what he or these times in which we live have to do with what you're writing about?
Right, and notable, and I appreciate your clarifying that this is not a book about Trump. And in fact, focusing on Trump is part of the problem that the book draws attention to. It is important to note that the subtitle says "In the Age of Trump," because there is something happening, you know, in this age. We saw it in the 2016 election. We saw it in. We've seen it increasingly in political discourse. This combination of fragile and bully that seems to infuse our communications. And so what I what I observed and continue to observe is this cycle, vicious circle of provocative displays, kind of with belittling and taunting. And a lot of times those happen on Twitter where there's not much room to explain yourself, so provocative works. And then, of course, the retaliation by whoever feels targeted. And that retaliation looks similar to what the provocation is a lot of times. There's the belittling, the put-downs. And then what emerges, and I think what we don't really fully talk about or understand, is this fragility, is then the person dishing it out becomes fragile and feels victimized, hurt. The other team is not playing fair. They're being, they're being haters. And that does a couple things. That brings the focus back on the bully, and it also justifies further aggression. So that we get engaged, and actually it seems that both sides do the same dance. This isn't all, I talk about a number of dances, but this is, I think, one that we see all over and over again.
So this is kind of the way a lot of our political discourse is being carried out right now. And not just in the words we're saying or typing, but also in just the way we are reacting to one another, and particularly when we are reacting to those who are kind of on the other side of the aisle or see things very differently from the way that we do, that you find some really unnerving parallels with what is often the interaction between a narcissist, a so-called fragile bully, and those in their immediate circle.
Yes. So, I talk about it both at the interpersonal level and at the cultural and political level. But what I think struck me in particular was this idea of collective narcissism, that not only do we, have our own varying degrees of vulnerability toward destructive narcissism, because narcissism isn't always destructive. A little bit can be a good thing. It's about self-advocacy. But with this level of this collective narcissism, what I saw is through the literature is that, for example, in the time leading up to the 2016 election, that that collective narcissism to seem to have a great deal of play, and what that, and that's empowered by feelings of vulnerability, even more so than feelings of grandiosity. So that fragile side, that feeling of they're being mean to me. The other side is bad. I have good intentions. I need to defend myself. And what we also saw, one study looked at unconscious hostility toward opposing parties and discrimination based on that hostility, and found that the degree of discrimination and hostile feelings based on party affiliation was more extreme than that based on race. So so this whole phenomenon of almost kind of this destructive narcissism kind of feeling like it's gone viral, is, I think, one of the most alarming findings of my book.
How long have you been interested in narcissism? Is this something that has come up a fair amount in the course of your practice as a clinical psychologist, or is it only more recently that you have begun to, first of all, see this more commonly, and have begun to develop such a concern and about an interest in it?
So I would say my interest in narcissism and in personality and disorders in general go way back. And I think part of it is I grew up in a very kind of intense family with a father who was both very charismatic, a preacher, someone who influenced me greatly, but also had this vulnerability that kind of hooked me in ways that weren't healthy. And so I think that some of what I was noticing in the air more recently felt familiar to me. And so it, I think there was that side of it where I needed to work something out for myself. But there also has been a lifelong kind of interest in this paradox, I think, because I was handed it as a child, this paradox of how do you manage, you know, feeling this need to take care of somebody who also may be bullying you, and how do you manage this attachment to somebody who seems to really have something to give and to kind of, you know, has this this sense of somebody who could save you even, and yet also then leaves you maybe more like Echo in the myth. You know, Echo is left with just a voice that repeats what Narcissus says. She's not any longer an embodied, independent person. So I think it goes way back, and my interest professionally in personality disorders, I worked with a lot of people who had severe personality disorders, what I've appreciated about that is that when you work with people at that end of the spectrum, you really have to to deal with your own stuff.
Yeah, right.
because what happens with personality disorders is the people who have them often don't feel much pain at all. It's the people in their midst that feel it. And yet the reactions that get set off in ourselves can reflect our own vulnerabilities and need for work.
Right.
So, yeah.
When you mention in the book's introduction about your relationship with your father, and what you call at one point his narcissistic personalization of a whole wide range of issues, one of the most interesting observations you make, aside from just talking about your own kind of complicated relationship with him, is the fact that you have 9 siblings. And
right.
So you've thought not only about your own relationship with your father and how you tried to deal with some of these narcissistic tendencies, but also that each of them had their own particular unique relationships with your father and were also dealing with him in their own particular way. Probably right from the start, you've had a more nuanced understanding of some of this than a lot of people do, I think our tendency is to think simplistically, particularly about things we don't understand all that well. So I think most people tend to think that one narcissist is pretty much like another narcissist, and those that
right.
love them are probably dealing with all of the same issues in pretty much the same way. Not at all.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that diverse perspective and even the ways in which my relationship with my father evolved and changed. And thankfully, you know, we worked through some things, which goes against the idea that that never can happen. But I think that helped me with the book to talk about a number of what I call destructive dances and how they can play out differently depending upon what the person brings to the relationship. Some people like to hide behind somebody who's a narcissist to be the echo. Some people like to combat. They like the drama. Some people will just kind of wither away and let the narcissist kind of stand for them. So, you know, there's or some people want to fix and take care of the narcissist. They see it as a, you know, a challenge. So we all have those different tendencies, and we all have our own levels of narcissism in the mix. So it's quite a complex stuff. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Lori Helgo about her brand new book, which is called Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. In this book, Dr. Helgo explores a number of different facets of narcissism, helps explain how narcissism occurs in all sorts of shapes and forms, that it is at least a small part of all of us, and for some people it is sort of the predominant trait that guides everything that they do and think and say. And, of course, narcissism can also become quite destructive to the person themselves, and certainly to those in their immediate orbit, for sure. And her book even explores the concept that I think is not going to be very familiar to many, of collective narcissism that
right.
We perhaps are seeing quite a lot in our current society. I really appreciate the first line of your first chapter when you write, "Narcissism is easier felt than defined." You go on to say, "We sense it through our own responses, fascinated and curious, shocked and irate, helpless, used, riveted. We feel bullied, yet compelled to hang around, either to take care of the bully or to try to win the losing battle. We freely respond with the label narcissist, often in retaliation, and those labeled don't seem to care anyway. Sometimes the label seems our only defense against that person in our life we can't seem to reach and also can't seem to ignore. But what is narcissism anyway?" And I really appreciate the time that you take to help us understand that. And I wonder if you could spell out for us what you describe as two divergent ways of understanding narcissism, because this is so crucial to any meaningful understanding and discussion of narcissism.
Right, right. So we're talking about the vulnerable and the grandiose side. Is that what you're...
I believe that's what you...
Yeah,
well,
that's right.
Well, and actually, yeah.
I'm sure I got the right place in my book, so, yes.
And actually, the very first thing in your book, right after you say this, where you actually talk about necessary narcissism. So,
yes.
So
yes.
The fact that there is some necessity of it in a healthy psychological makeup.
Right. I think there's more than probably two divergent ways, but one. I think divergence is this idea that narcissism is a bad thing. It just, you know, even people use the term as a diagnosis when it's not. It's narcissism is a human thing. It's simply at its base self-interest. So we need some of that. And the lack of narcissism, Craig Malkin talks a lot about this, is a problem too. And in fact, those might be the people who gravitate toward people on the other end of the continuum. But so I think emerging in the whole field of psychology and psychiatry is this idea that mental health disorders exist more on a continuum, that they're ubiquitous. The qualities, the traits are ubiquitous. We all have degrees of these things. I think with narcissism in particular, narcissistic disorders, we like to, you know, project them onto the monsters that are the mascots, you know, for narcissism. And the problem with that is then we engage in these dances where we're playing the music and dancing the steps, and we can kind of deny our own, you know, culpability in the destruction. So I think that's one divergence, I think, is between this idea of, you know, narcissism as always bad and the more nuanced understanding. But the other way that we can kind of complicate the picture is that narcissism, when we think of it, we usually think of the grandiose braggart, you know, the person with the puffed up chest, high on themselves. And we often neglect what is called vulnerable narcissism. And more research is starting to look at that end of the continuum, and also the interplay within people between this vulnerability and this grandiosity. So the vulnerable narcissist is the one who, if you have, if there's any hint of criticism, what you say, maybe you ask that person to do, you know, could you help a little more with this? They feel so devastated that you've suggested that they're not perfect that the focus becomes on themselves and they, you know, may fall apart. And that is a kind of narcissism too, right? And it also, there's even some bullying in that because the person really, through their emotionality, through their vulnerability, kind of threatens their own self-destruction if you tamper with this illusory sense of, you know, grandiosity, quiet grandiosity maybe in the vulnerable narcissism.
Right. And in a moment, we'll explore this matrix of various kinds of narcissism, which that really helps us kind of understand this really intriguing concept of the fragile bully that is, of course, the title of your book and the heart of so much of this conversation. I thought it was interesting in the first chapter of the book when you kind of try to spell out when narcissism becomes a diagnosis of a disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD, and you kind of spell all that out. One of the things you say is that pathological narcissism is not a temporary ailment, but rather a reliable way of being in the world. It is egocentric. I mean, I understand what you're saying in that first part, in that first sentence, and it's fascinating. Can you explain the term egocentric and what that has to do with it?
Yes, yes. This is what makes it so challenging. So, in a sense, the ego is in on it. And what I mean by ego, I'm using the sense of the organizing aspect of personality. So it is the way the person learns to cope and manage the world. So let's say, you know, in childhood, and there may be different theories about what might happen in the childhood of somebody who becomes, you know, kind of develops this armor, is you have perhaps parents who are so self-involved that they can't adequately mirror the child. They can't adequately kind of show the child who he or she is. Instead, they kind of require the child to always mirror them to bolster their, you know, sense of self. That child may need to kind of develop this grandiose kind of stand-in for a sense of self and kind of build that and as a substitute for any authentic sense of self. On the other hand, you may have parents who are very, very focused on the child, but only on particular qualities, you know, the star athlete. In fact, I think of a student I had who actually wrote a paper about his, when we were studying personality, about his own narcissism because he had this idea that he was great regardless, you know, this you know, he was a talented athlete, and that trying or putting any effort in forward would somehow shatter that image, so he would not study for tests and he would fail. And it was a dilemma for him, but somehow it would betray this image that he had built up about himself to actually study for his test. So, you know, we have that other kind of this sense of an edited self that becomes reinforced. But for whatever reason, the ego kind of builds around this grandiose construction and works very hard to maintain it. And so you see things like narcissistic rage when somebody scratches, you know, tries to, you know, to push over that construct and dirty it. this narcissistic rage that might retaliate, get the focus instead on, you know, you're a loser, you're whatever, and help to kind of have allow that person to stay kind of put together in a sense. And so egocentric contrasts with ego dystonic, which are things like depression and anxiety, where the person knows something's wrong. The person is actually in distress and often will seek help. They're easy for therapists to work with because they want help and they know something is off. Somebody who has an egocentric disorder is likely not to even seek help, but others in the vicinity of them will often be the ones that are doing the work to kind of help hold this person together.
Right, because
whether
the narcissist
they want to or not.
Right, the narcissist sees no problem and as a matter of fact probably would resent the very notion that there is a problem, that they have a problem, or that they're causing
right.
a problem in others, and would also be resistant of anything that would, in a sense, wrench from them the device, in a sense, by which they make sense of the world and navigate through the world. As you're talking about this, what I thought was especially fascinating is when you say narcissism, among other things, seems to repel depression. That, that apparently very seldom will we see a narcissist who is depressed or dealing with depression. It is almost as though it is a kind of armor by which they would keep at bay maybe that which might lead to or might lead to depression. That's a fascinating concept in and of itself, since we hear so much about depression being a widespread problem in American society.
Right, right. What we don't realize is that depression often is a effort toward healing. And so in the case of narcissism, if one becomes depressed, if somebody with a narcissistic disorder becomes depressed, that actually can be an opening in the armor and an openness to change.
We're speaking with Dr. Lori Helgo, and we're talking about her book, Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. It is a very close examination of what narcissism is and helps us come to a better understanding of how narcissism functions, the harm that it can do. We're going a little actually out of order, but I think one thing that would be interesting for us to touch on before we talk a little bit about this matrix that kind of spells out different forms of narcissism is to just talk for a second about the myth. I mean, and that mythological figure, a narcissist from which we get the term narcissism. And you devote a chapter to this in which you actually also talk about that myth in kind of its briefest form, but then in a more detailed form, which in a sense gives us a more detailed picture of where all this comes from.
Yes, yes. Well, the myth is so generative in understanding the nuances of narcissism, if you look at it. I think the simple version, yes, is that narcissist looked in at his reflection, he fell in love with it, and eventually wasted away, or some people think he fell in the pool and drowned, but whatever happened, you know, he just got eaten up by his own self-focus. Well, if we look closer at the myth, it reveals a lot more. For example, there's Echo in the myth, who follows him and is enamored of him, like everybody is. Everybody's enamored of Narcissus. Men, women, they all, and they've been slighted. You know, he's dumped them all, left them all on the wayside, and yet he hears Echo's Echo, and wants to see her, wants to engage her, and she's very excited, and for a moment has this self-efficacy and comes to him and embraces him, and he says, "Away in circling arms," and banishes her. She doesn't let go, as a lot of times people don't, and they would try to break off with somebody with a destructive level of narcissism. She pines for him. She wants to solve this unsolvable dilemma, and she eventually wastes away and is turned to stone, and only Echo remains. So, but what happens to Narcissus is something that we don't get the whole story a lot of times. So he has been cursed to look at his own reflection and to fall in love with himself in the same way everyone else has fallen in love with him, and to feel the pain of not being able to have himself. What the myth reveals is that Narcissus does not have a sense of self. If we have a sense of self, we can walk in the world and engage with others. We carry around a sense of self. He's locked in the mirror. And I think this is the challenge of this is the sad reality of narcissism, is that he eventually starves and wastes away just as Echo does. Because he's not getting anything from external relationships. All he is getting this rigid reflection back and held in this dilemma. When he does waste away, however, this is the hopeful part of the myth. He goes to Hades. He goes to another reflection, which, this vicious circle again. But what is left in his place is the flower, the narcissus. And the narcissus flower represents memory. And the idea is that if we can move past our narcissism, because I talk about in the book, we all go through phases of development where narcissism is necessary, where we need to feel that grandiosity. And yet we also, when we walk and start to feel like the world is our oyster, we also need to fall and recognize that we're vulnerable. Well, so the narcissism is best held as a memory, as an ideal, a memory that we can remember those times and symbolize them. We can have we don't invest our whole identities in them. If we're a celebrity in some way, we can see that as a symbol of narcissism, but not as the whole identity. And I think that's the hope in the myth, is that there is a way to manage narcissism, if we don't invest our entire self into this idea.
It's so interesting to think about this myth coming down to us from so long ago, Ovid in the year 8 A.D., and just to think about what might have prompted the creation of such a myth. And I'm so glad that you take the time to spell it out for us. I think we have not yet perhaps clarified for our listeners this matter of the fragile bully and the fragile bully matrix that you spend some time with in the book, in which I think you believe can really help us have a more sophisticated understanding of how narcissism plays out and under the circumstances, the circumstances under which it really becomes a problem. Explain what this bully, fragile bully matrix is all about.
Sure. So we have two different kind of more nuanced ways of looking at narcissism. One is that it's on a continuum from like zero narcissism to all the way to the malignant pathological extreme that really kind of melds into sociopathy. It's so we have that extreme. We have the degree of narcissism. So if we look at that as the vertical axis going from moderate narcissism all the way to extreme, that's kind of where this discussion is about, right? So we have that on one axis, and then on the other, on the horizontal axis, we can look at the spectrum of narcissism from fragile to bully. So we do have some people who really kind of inhabit more of that vulnerable narcissism in a purer way, and they really shy away from criticism. They tend to be fall apart easily. They more likely would kind of feel feelings of shame if exposed in any negative way. And then the bully extreme, who seems, some have called this extreme the oblivious narcissist, who doesn't seem to care that much what people think, but just very much bullies people to and kind of control the feedback they get. And then in the middle, this fragile bully, where these two come together more. So if we look at it as a matrix, we can see people at who have, maybe are at the top, at the extreme level of narcissism, but maybe on the vulnerable side or more on the bully side or more in the middle. We can see people who have moderate levels and who are more the people that, there's some room for movement in relationships, and there's some room for empathy and some characteristics that we tend to not see as associated with pathological narcissism. And so we theoretically you can kind of place people at any place in this matrix and have a more nuanced understanding of kind of what you're dealing with.
And of course among the various sort of ramifications of this, one can easily see how, for instance, something as disturbing as domestic abuse can be found in this matrix. And the thought of, for instance, an abusive spouse being a so-called fragile bully, it's such an intriguing concept.
Yes, and there is some evidence that when the fragile and bully come together, they seem to come together at that more pathological level. So we would need probably even more complex model to accommodate, that. But I think that's, and we see that a lot in abuse, where the bully actually has the other person taking care of them. And it with child abuse, it's particularly destructive, because children will often take care of their abusers because they see that fragility.
So much of your book is taken up then with a series of what you call dances in which those that are living with or around such a narcissist, such a fragile bully, will be dancing in order to keep them caring for them in some way, or just sort of dealing with the relentless ramifications of living with someone like this. And more than once you talk about vicious circles and cyclical patterns of behavior that we so often see. And of course that's especially sad when we think about somebody being caught in something really unfortunate and they just cannot escape from whatever vicious cycle right. It happens to be.
Yes. Yes. And I think looking at narcissism in a relational context really empowers us, even though it's tempting to want to put the narcissist in isolation and it's something out there. I think the reality is it's in here. We're the ones feeling often the pain. And so that we really need to get, I think, that contextual understanding.
Your foreword is written by someone by the name of Paul Wachtel, and he, a lot of his work has really helped you frame this part of the book. And you tell us that his model for understanding narcissism is very useful in understanding the subtle but powerful mechanisms that feed narcissism. And that's a really scary concept, to think about something being subtle yet powerful, because so often we miss the things that are subtle in our lives and might go about our business not even realizing exactly what's going on. Tell our listeners about at least some of these dances of narcissism that you have observed and that we need to know about.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Paul Wachtel because I owe a great debt to him and his theory. He really pulled together so much of what was warring within psychology in terms of our theories, and with this idea of vicious circles. And an example he gives, I think, that just makes it very clear of a vicious circle in relationships is where one spouse says, I nag because you drink. And the other says, I drink because you nag. And that's, that's going to just keep going, right? And so this is an example of something I call the provoke and react that we see in narcissism, in destructive narcissism, where there's a provocation, a retaliation, and then this kind of need to defend oneself, that feeling of fragility emerging. And that can just keep going. And we see that in politics all the time. It's just, and to the point where we forget the issues, but it's all about the retaliation and who's going to have the more clever comment or the better put down. We have the reassurance dance, which is one that I was very familiar with as a child, where you really are trying to build up someone, and in so doing, make them dependent on that. And at the same time, neglect your own needs. And so that is another hook. The superior dance is a very interesting one, especially for therapists. It's a big hook we can get into, which is that, I'll just, analyze and understand this person and fix them, and which is a huge trap. Because, again, so many of these result in oneself being inflated in whatever way, getting the focus, and then the other one kind of dying off. So true engagement, on the other hand, means that both people are in the room, and I talk a lot about how we can do that and break the cycle. But sometimes, as in the movie War Games came to the conclusion, is that sometimes the only winning move is not to play.
Fortunately, there at least is some reason for hope that one, mm-hmm. even if you are engaging in these narcissistic dances for one reason or another, it does not always have to be so. And the last part of your book is sort of a destructive dance detox, as one of the chapters is titled, in which you are trying to help people think about ways in which they can disengage from such dances. Share with our listeners maybe a couple of your central thoughts on what one might think about if you are caught in one or more of these difficult and relentless dances.
Right. So I'll start with collective narcissism. As I mentioned that at the beginning, and especially with our socio-political discourse now, there seems to be a lot of that in the air. And one fascinating finding about the difference between groups that were high in collective narcissism and other groups is not that the groups took pride in themselves, but it was that the groups kind of defined by collective narcissism really tended to have this kind of victim mentality that the other side, the focus was on the other side and how bad the other side was. And that, but that there was nothing really unhealthy or particularly narcissistic about a group that believes strongly in its own principles and wants to, further them. I think this is what we lose sight of, is that we can get so caught up in this dance of destruction and which is oddly a dance of self-preservation, rather than this kind of inspired interest in sharing what changes and what kind of vision we have. I think my hope is that is the best of what democracy holds, is that there is an opportunity for people to have a voice. I think we've become so often just echoes and voiceless. I think it was Thomas Mann who talked about our endless ability to repair ourselves, or Tocqueville, both of whom had that idea, that kind of idealized notion of democracy, but that we do have that ability to repair ourselves and to step back.
Right. And your 17th chapter, I think, is especially important and, of course, perfectly timely, titled Mending the Narcissistic Divide, in which you offer up some thoughts on how we can step beyond this narcissistic tribalism that sometimes feels like it is going to tear us apart. Just how American a phenomenon is this business of narcissism, and how much is it?
There was a study that I cited saw and found that narcissism is a part of our assumed national character when other people from other countries rate us, and when we rate ourselves. Interestingly enough, we rate, you know, Americans in general as more narcissistic than ourselves individually, so we tend to see it in others much more easily than ourselves. But it does tend to be a part of what we kind of see as this national character, national personality, and for better and worse. I mean, I think we provide a lot of entertainment for the world. There's a certain boldness to the American vision that can be inspiring. So I think that's part of it. I think, and what I talk about in Chapter 17, is that paradoxically, we also have this constant interest in criticizing ourselves, you know, in looking at ourselves, and maybe that's in some ways narcissistic, but it's a healthier version of it, I think, is that we also are willing to remake ourselves over and over again, and I think that is part of our hope.
Well, the book gives us a lot to think about, that is for sure. The book again is titled Fragile Bully: Understanding Our Destructive Affair with Narcissism in the Age of Trump. It's published by Diversion Books, the author, Laurie Helgo. Laurie Helgo, thank you so much, first of all, for writing such an interesting book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I am so glad we had this conversation.
Oh, I am too. It's really nice when we can get to these nuances in a radio talk forum, so I appreciate it very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to speak with a faculty colleague of mine from the music department at Carthage College, Dr. Mark Petering. Mark Petering, in addition to teaching at Carthage, is a very busy and successful composer. And as a matter of fact, one of his works is one of the featured works on the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, a piece called Cityscape. And we will talk with Mark Petering tomorrow, not only about that particular piece, but also about his whole career as a composer and his philosophy as a composer and how he works with aspiring young composers. On Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. On Thursday, the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. And on Friday, we will be celebrating the 150th anniversary of PEO, the Philanthropic Educational Organization. This is a women's organization that started very modestly with six women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, who wanted to do what they could to further the ambitions of women in the field of education. And the organization has grown in dramatic ways in the 150 years since.